From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his book, Plain But Wholesome, Brock Cheney writes about a massive feast ordered by the Mormon prophet Brigham Young in the summer of 1849. Young knew the Mormons' survival in this arid new landscape depended on their skill as farmers working in harsh conditions. And as Cheney puts it, they not only conquered, but they feasted. Their survival would depend also on their ability to preserve the food that they had harvested, and many of those practices survive today in one form or another. Today in the program, we're talking about canning, not just as a process, though we hope the process is useful. We're also talking about the tradition and the customs of what, for many, is a family ritual. We invite you to join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West and Buck Fabrizio. Right now, the summer bounty is just coming in, but the harvest season really isn't that far off, which means pretty soon, if not already, people throughout the state will be canning tomatoes and beets and making pickles and jellies. Some will be freezing the bounty of the season. Some will be drying it. Some will be burying it to extend its life. And many people will use the recipes and the techniques passed down from a mother's mother's mother, methods born of real necessity. Well, today in the program, we're talking about the methods of preserving food, and not just as a process, though we hope the conversation is going to be actually useful and practical. We're also talking about the traditions and the customs of these family rituals, especially as they relate back to the time of the Mormon pioneers. Joining us first on the program is Brock Cheney. He is the author of a book about Mormon pioneer foodways. It's a book called Plain But Wholesome, and he's joining us here in the studio. And Brock Cheney, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So I guess I wanted to start with the word foodways. What does that mean? What do you mean? Because I want to really get into how you started thinking about all of this.
My mentor in college was Jay Anderson, who was a sort of pioneer in the foodways field. And he studied food at Plymouth Plantation, so the pilgrim food from 400 years ago. And his definition of foodways is rather coarse, perhaps, but we might say it in a radio sort of way to say from germination to defecation.
Right.
So from the planting of the seed through all of the production processes, including...
Or from seed to the other S word, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, no,
so
I read that too.
Everything about the making of the food, the preparing, all of the customs about the eating of the food, and then in the end, the manure back to the original seed to grow the next crop. So it's foodways is anything having to do with the growing or eating of food.
Did people, and we'll get to Mormon pioneers in particular, but did these cultures think about it in that cycle? You know, that it was, that they thought about it as a sort of a system, that it started here and it ends back around here and we start over again?
When you say that they were thinking about it, I'm not sure that they thought about it.
Yeah.
I think that they knew that that's what it was,
right.
But it was not something that they concerned themselves. It's just how it was.
So when did you come up with this particular idea? Because you write in your book about how when you started thinking about all of this, that you figured that it would just be – there would be so much information and it would just be a matter of compiling it all. But you say that wasn't really the case.
Well, exactly. Growing up, of course, in my family, we have a lot of food traditions coming down through generations, and I just assumed that everybody would have such things going on.
Yeah.
And a lot of folks that I talked to initially seemed to say, oh, yeah, this is grandma's what. But I guess my first thought about it, I'd worked in living history museums for years, and as such, most of the history of the West is agricultural history.
Yeah.
And so we grew crops, we processed the harvest, we ate meals together. And so that was my professional experience in living history museums. Then one day I was at another museum and somebody was doing a food demonstration And I asked her about her documentation for this demonstration, and she said, actually, there isn't anything written about Mormon food in the West in the pioneer days, that there are quite a few cookbooks from the East, for example, the Buckeye Cookbook or earlier Mrs. Collins' Great Western Cookbook. But as far as documentation for Mormon pioneer history, there was none. And I thought, well, wouldn't that be a great idea? I mean, after all, there's every summer throngs and throngs of children that go out on these Mormon pioneer handcart treks.
Yeah, yeah.
And what do they eat? I think that they try not to drive off the kids by forcing them to eat disgusting things. But I think if they knew that they could eat well and eat authentically, yeah, maybe they would do that. So that was kind of my initial impetus in writing.
But why? Why weren't people writing this stuff down, do you think?
Well, I think different cultures have different traditions, perhaps. And here in the Mormon culture in the West, the tradition was a rote memorization, yeah, of things handed down verbally.
It was an oral tradition then.
Yeah, exactly. And so in the course of research, I found manuscripts where the third or fourth generation in Utah said, I'm finally writing this down after my grandmother is on the edge of death.
Yeah.
And so it has to be recorded. Eventually, we turned to a written tradition instead of the oral tradition. But though there were a few published manuscripts in early pioneer history, my friend Stephen Shepherd did a facsimile recreation of the first territorial catalog of the territorial library. And in that 1852 facsimile, he shows several published cookbooks from the East. But that wasn't the basis of Mormon cooking. Mormon pioneer folks cooked from rote memory.
Wow. I wanted to ask you about you say in the book that what we eat and how we eat reveal volumes about who we are and how we think. Give me a sense of then what kinds of conclusions you're coming to about what you've been, you know, what is the identity of the Mormons from their foodway traditions?
Well,
does that make sense? What are you learning from that?
I think we could draw a stark contrast between the Mormons historically as a culture and the Mormons in modern day as a culture, just based on what they eat. For example, historically, going towards the food preservation end of things, the Mormons relied on organic methods for food preservation. So they unwittingly or knowingly cultured all sorts of bacteria in the food production and storage process. And so it was a much more organic sort of an approach to food, whereas in the modern day, we rather turn away from such bacterial concoctions, and instead we use chemical preservatives or heat treatments or frozen approaches to preserving our food. So just in that singular element, I think we can see that the Mormon pioneers were much more comfortable working with
scary bacteria.
Exactly. And today we're afraid of that. It seems that we're quite afraid of bacteria.
Do you think that some of the wisdom, some of the traditions that relate to that bacteria, that some of that is just gone, you know, that we can't get some of that back? Some of those ideas were passed on it at some point. They just disappeared. Do you think some of that stuff is missing?
I think it's still present somewhere.
Huh.
And I think we can find it if we want to find it, if we want to look for it. I think that we tend to think that the United States experience is true of everywhere in the world. But certainly if you were to go down to South America, there would be people using the same sorts of processes, the same bacteria to do the same sorts of treatments on their food. It's not gone. It's just
somewhere else.
Gone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
So do you feel a sense of and we'll get to this with some of our other guests related to the questions of preserving food in particular. But Do you feel a sense of urgency in some way of trying to gather up this stuff before some of it does disappear? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think as a folklorist, I was talking to one of my professors the other day and talking about this idea of hurry, grab it up before it's gone. And folklorists, I think, have gotten over that idea, knowing that you can't keep anything static forever.
Yeah.
I mean, we look at the Amish, and though they have tried to keep a static sort of a culture, they too have changed and evolved their practices over the course of years. Or Mormons is the contemporary example.
Yeah.
We like to think that Mormonism is the same today and forever, but oh no, it's. And so things will carry on and change and evolve, and there is no stopping the moment of time.
You wrote this. I wanted to ask you about this. You mentioned the anthropologist Mary Douglas, who proposes that the foods a society eats might reveal a code.
Yeah, that's a curious idea, I think, that that our foods could say a secret code about what we value and who holds the power and who is subject to the power and so on. And I think that perhaps anthropologists might revel in that sort of notion. But in the end, I wonder if when we sit down to a meal, all of that is theoretical in the ivory tower. And
right.
The meal itself is just a meal. But yeah. I'm sure that the academia that explores such ideas, they would love to assign such values to it, though I'm not sure if it's relevant to my meal for lunch today.
Right, right. Well, you know, I was interested in you talk about the idea of there are a couple of conflicting themes in the book, which are interesting. I mean, you have these moments of abundance and communal feasting, and then you also have these periods of, you know, privation and hardship. You write about that. And I was really interested in the tradition of feasting. You write this, that Mormon feasts verge on becoming a religious sacrament. And I'm wondering, do we still see these kinds of feasts in Mormon culture today? Are they different in significant ways or similar in significant
ways? Gosh, that's – you know, I think about growing up and going to the harvest bazaar at the church. And this was in the 70s, of course. In the 80s, there was the correlation movement that rather took a lot of the individual choices out of the observances of individual congregations. And that seemed to have really had a harsh impact on these sorts of feasts. I think they still do go on
yeah.
from time to time, but they don't seem to happen in an every year sort of a way,
yeah.
at least in the congregations that I have known. Now, there are perhaps some singular exceptions up in Providence in 2 weeks, Providence, Utah, and Cache Valley. They're going to have the sauerkraut dinner, which they have stubbornly persisted in keeping in spite of correlation. But I think those sorts of things are rather exceptions than the broadly common sorts of things that I remember as a child.
This idea of correlation, it's interesting. Do you think then that for efficiency's sake, for the idea of dealing with a church that was growing, that they stripped away inadvertently some – not just feasting rituals, but it seems rituals of working on, you know, steak farms.
Of course, with the explosion of the church in population around the world, as all things that grow have to change. And
yeah.
so there's, you know, that notion that time will carry on and people will change to meet accordingly. And that's just as it is. And there is no halting the moment and preserving the past. It will carry on. And sometimes things are lost.
Yeah. So what did it mean to do this kind of research? Did it mean interviews with people? I mean, the stuff that wasn't always stuff, as you say, you couldn't find in some book somewhere, written down somewhere? Did you have to find it by just interviews, conversations?
Well, some things were interviews. For example, my friend in Providence that makes the sauerkraut for the sauerkraut dinner coming up. We had a great chat about that, and he shared his approach to sauerkraut with me. Other things had been written down and recorded by the third or fourth generation. If you go up to the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers Museum up on the top of Main Street, they have an extensive archive of things that have been written down by the third and fourth generation that really did a great job of recording some of these food processes. So there were some it went to diaries, it went to newspapers. I tried to comb everywhere I could think of that somebody might have something to say about food in Utah 100 or 150 years ago. So it was quite an adventure, yeah.
Yeah.
I quite enjoyed the research more than the writing. The writing is so lonely.
Brock Cheney is with us. I want to get another couple of voices involved in the conversation when we get back from a break. Brock's book is called Plain But Wholesome, Foodways of the Mormon Pioneers. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation about preserving the food of the season, canning and freezing and drying, because for many people, this is as much a ritual as it is a task. So we're talking as much about traditions as methods. Brock Cheney was one of our guests. He's the author of a book called Plain But Wholesome, Foodways of the Mormon Pioneers. We also had with us Allison Enerson, who teaches classes on food preservation for a group of local nonprofits. And Carly Gillespie was also with us, a co-owner of Bug Farms. It's an urban farm here in Salt Lake City. So let me – I wanted to get your – Allison, let's start with you. When did you start preserving food? Was it – this is something that you learned from your grandmother, I guess.
Something I learned from my great-grandmother, and then my grandmother, and also I was just recalling a moment in there where I would help put up corn, freezing corn, with my grandfather. He was the corn guy, so he grew it, and then we picked it, and we brought it home, and we blanched it and cut it off the cob. So definitely a lot of tradition in my family over food preservation, but great-grandma taught me first with strawberry jam.
Strawberry jam.
25 cents of ice cream bucket. We had to go and collect all the berries ourselves, yeah, yeah. And then we got to help with the process as well.
What did you like about the process? Did you like the process at first?
Well, no. I mean, you just were in it for the fresh berries and the quarters, right?
Yeah.
But the process, I mean, you know, just being at the elbow of my grandmother, my great-grandmother in the kitchen, it's magical. And it's a process that I want to preserve for my own kids now. I mean, just looking back on it, it was precious. Back then, it was, you know, child labor.
Right. Well put.
With a delicious benefit.
Absolutely, yes. Carly, when did you start?
I actually started fairly recently. 2009 was the first time I preserved anything. Speaking to these guys earlier, you know, I didn't really grow up with a lot of canning or food preservation in my life. I'm a child of the 80s. And yeah. So, you know, we had like cereal and Del Monte cans and that sort of stuff. And I've been sort of on a journey to sort of reconnect with my food system and find out where my food's coming from, eat more locally. And so this was sort of a natural progression when I had a garden that was really bountiful and I needed to preserve that food somehow. So I sort of feel like I'm maybe creating my own food traditions for my family later on.
You know, this is so interesting because, Allison, you've mentioned to us that you're the one that taught your mother how to can tomatoes. So this idea that it skipped a generation, I keep hearing about this, that that it did. It skipped a generation. So a lot of people are learning it from their grandmothers, their great-grandmothers, not their mothers. Their mothers weren't interested for some reason. Why do you figure that is?
Well, I think it's, you know, it was the generation, it was that generation, the 60s. Women wanted to exercise the privilege not to be in the kitchen if they didn't want to.
Yeah.
And to buy things at the grocery store and have those levels of convenience and TV dinners and all those things. And we had no idea that those foods weren't going to be good for us. We didn't know what we were losing, I think, in that. So now I think it's definitely people going back to their grandmothers, or it's very much like a young woman generation thing where we're teaching each other.
Yeah.
It's one of the things I get so excited about, because a lot of the women are my age or slightly younger or vastly younger. And that it's thrilling to me to know that I can bring it in, teach it to them, and they go out and teach it to other people. That's part of what I love about it. It's,
you know,
really
this
community.
This idea of skipping generations, it makes me think about the 70s and the whole back to the land movement, and then the 80s with their hedonistic indulgences and, you know, but
it, and bowls of Captain Crunch.
Right. And so you missed it, and then here it comes again, and it'll come and it'll go. And it makes me think back to the pioneers, that the first Danish pioneers, for example, they had to build a farm to begin with, and they didn't have the liberty of indulging in their ancestral foods. They were just trying to get away from starving.
Yeah.
But then by the time their children had come along, then they could reinvigorate some of these old traditions. And it seems like over the course of Utah's history, it comes and it goes and it comes and it goes. It'll be gone again, and then somebody will dig it out of somewhere,
yeah,
and then there we go.
Yeah. I want to get to the joy of the experience as we go along, but let's take a few phone calls. Jason has been waiting. He's in Providence. Jason, welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Doug.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment, first, I appreciate your show and the variety of topics you have, but this is interesting for me. This year, I did my first canning in a long time. My mom did a lot of canning growing up. She comes from, Utah Pioneer stock, and I remember growing up for canning pears and peaches and cans and jellies. But in particular, a family favorite is what we call chili sauce, made with tomatoes, onions, peppers, and it's really a sweet sauce. And through the years that she's gotten older, she stopped doing about all canning except for the chili sauce, and even that's cut back, but we like it so much. I decided I wanted to learn how to do it, and so did it for the first time this year, which was a fun thing to do with my mom, and also learn that the history there. She said the original recipe, as far as she knows, came from her grandmother and was told that they used it with the venison that they would try and put up and keep through the year to help, make the venison taste better as they ate it through the years. And that's what she told me the history was, which was interesting. We mainly make tacos out of it now, which it's a really kind of a sweet sauce. It's not really Mexican at all, but it's just kind of a family favorite that's developed out of that.
Man, it is so not Mexican. Allison, you're nodding. You have a chili sauce.
Chili sauce.
Yeah.
I mean, you cannot buy it in the store. And it's basically like a thick, sort of funky ketchup, right?
Funky ketchup, that is exactly right.
It has
right.
allspice and cloves and cinnamon, and I put jalapenos in mine. So mine is definitely a different version from what Graham gave me. I call it Graham's chili sauce, and I make little labels for it and everything. And my brothers go nuts-o-rama when they get a jar of chili sauce from me, because I'm the only one that still – well, my sister still makes it, but she's in Colorado. So that is a truly Utah thing.
Totally.
But now I have to call you out on being a tradition destroyer.
Yeah,
it's not Graham's chili sauce if you add jalapenos.
It's not. It's a version of
If my mother is listening, Mom, if you're listening, you have a chili sauce. Maybe you could call us and tell us how you make it. I love it.
Yeah, you don't share
it's
the recipe.
Weird.
You never share
recipes.
Oh,
no, never mind, maybe. Okay.
Yeah, secret. It's a secret.
Right. Jason, thanks very much. Kathleen is in Alpine, Utah. Kathleen, hi.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Oh, I grew up in a home with a grandfather who was born in 1870s and a great aunt who was born in the 1880s. And food was just real basic for us. I married into a family also with pioneer stock, but boy, they sure celebrated food. But I can remember this joke that was told when I was a little kid about canning, and who knew there were jokes about canning? But the one that I remember my mother telling it to these older this older generation, and they just thought this was the funniest thing. But there was apparently a British person was visiting in Utah and was just very impressed with all the canning that everyone did, and just thought they were very clever to can basically everything. And they said, yeah, we have an expression. We can what we can, and what we can't, we can. And she just thought that was very clever. And so when she returned to England, she was telling them about these clever folks out there that had this great expression. And as she told it to them was, we can what we can, and what we can't, we put in tins. And I just remember my grandparents and great aunt just chuckling, thinking that was so clever. And it's been years since I thought of that, but your conversation today reminded me of the old canning joke.
Yeah. Good. Well, we're glad you shared. Thanks.
Thanks.
Let's take another call from Nicole. Nicole's in Ogden. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Doug. I love your show.
Thanks.
I'm a big fan. I just laughed listening about chili sauce recipes, because we have our own, and it was from my great-grandmother, and it's written down in print, so it's not going anywhere. But it doesn't sound like the ones that were being spoken of. I just wanted to share and kind of put a thought out there. I was born in 78, and when I went to college, my mother also went to college, and when I started having my kids, I've been married for 12 years now, and started to want to preserve, you know, do canning, and it came mostly from a lack of one of my favorite condiments, pear jam, which you can't find in the store, and so I made my own pear jam, but I didn't have my mom there to tell me, because she had gone to school and then had her own career. And so it's interesting to see where you have to find the bits and pieces of what you want to bring into your own life. When I learned to do peaches, I asked an elderly woman in our congregation, and she told me the specific variety to buy and what fruit stand to go to, and she walked me through peaches, and so she taught me how to do that part of something that we love. But then I was thinking, my grandmother just had her 80th birthday, and so she was, you know, she came through the Depression, and she has still in her basement a full wall of canned cherries. And so it's this living history art. Nobody would dare open them. and nobody's done anything with them, but they haven't touched them, you know, because with grandma and grandpa, you know, you don't throw things away, because that's how they were raised. But it's interesting that she canned those, she bottled them, and then I think as things became more convenient and the economy got better, she turned to the convenience items at the store.
I think that's the story. You know, it raises a question, any of you actually here, Allison and Carly, you in particular. So where do you go? Let's say where do you go? Let's say you don't have a grandmother who did all of this, and your mom doesn't really know. I mean, where do you go if you want to start?
Well, the classes, first of all, I mean, there are a lot of different organizations doing canning classes, including the series that we're doing. And this is with Downtown Alliance and Slow Food Utah and Wasatch Community Gardens, and also Harmon's. It's a big sponsor of this. So our classes are happening throughout October. IFA, Intermountain Farmers Association, does a series of classes. There's really a lot of opportunity now to learn it.
You know, whether you're a Mormon or not, do you think you'd go to a local ward and find this stuff?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah. They do all kinds of canning classes in the local ward houses. The Presbyterian Church by my street also does them. So I think there are a lot of really energetic women, you know, in their grandmothers who want to pass these traditions down. And they'll pass them to whomever wants to listen, because, you know, they're fabulous and brilliant. Like peaches. My great-grandmother made peaches, and I recently found out the reason they were so good that everybody loved them is because they were like 50% sugar. She put so much sugar, and I had no – like, mine just don't taste the same. Well, you know, I'm trying not to, like, choke my kids up on a bunch of sugar, but that's why. So Those resources are definitely out there, and we want to teach as many people as possible.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I live up in Willard, and so you have to drive the Fruit Highway to get to my place. And peach season has just ended up there.
Yeah.
But if you go up the highway there any time through late summer, early fall, and stop at any one of the fruit stands along through there, you're going to bump into somebody who cans. The people who run the fruit stands, they know what the best approach is for their fruit, and they care a lot about their fruit.
Yeah.
So it's all over. Even the internet. Just last week, I learned how to pickle eggs off of the internet.
There are though a lot of scientific methods that you need to follow. So,
yeah.
And it's best to have someone in the kitchen with you that knows what they're doing to show you those processes. And it's not, like I say, once you know the rules, it's really easy to do, but you need to know the rules.
How long did it take you to figure it out?
I'm still figuring it out.
Yeah.
Like I said, I started in 2009, and I'm very lucky in the way that I'm a community gardener, and so a lot of times when you're surrounded by gardeners, everyone has a method of kind of preserving things, so you can talk to your community members. The local food movement is very big here, so in the local food community, I had a lot of resources that way. But even as I've been going to these classes that Allison's been teaching for us, I've been like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. That's what she's saying not to do is exactly what I did, and I'm not going to do that again. So again, like learning the rules has been really important to me. And but I think you're always learning and growing and kind of finding new recipes and chatting with people who do different things.
I have to say, Brock, more than about the internet is that you're actually talking to people. That you're actually kind of exchanging. You know, you're sharing your knowledge. Somebody else has something else. I like this idea of getting people together. That seems part of the joy of it, right?
I think that everything that, like, from gardening, from growing the food to buying it at the farmer's market, getting to meet the farmers and preserving food, it's all about building community around food. And I think that's what the Mormons did a lot, is kind of building this community around their food system and around preserving their food. And I think it's a really important part of the canning process.
Which is what we've really lost when we lose the Harvest Bazaar. Of course, we lose the Harvest Bazaar because we've lost the harvest.
Yeah.
We just don't have a harvest anymore, and so we can't celebrate the harvest like we did, or at least as a community where everybody participates in it. So that's the sadness to me, that modernization, more than anything, seems to alienate us from each other, where long ago they were community processes. You couldn't harvest a wheat field all by yourself. It simply wasn't a one-man job.
Yeah.
And so we had to come together. But these days, I could go out back and pick my own peach tree and take it into my own house and do it all by myself.
But it's not fun.
Yeah, exactly. The good thing is that a peach tree makes more peaches than one person can eat.
Right.
So does a zucchini plant.
Exactly.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Let me mention a few comments on Twitter. Our good friend, food writer Vanessa Cheng, chimed in this morning saying, Mama Cheng always did right with kimchi in a freezer. We also heard from Ingrid, who said, I grew up on a farm. We had a huge garden. My mom, an immigrant from Holland, would can and dehydrate everything. I have great memories of the fruit leather and dried apples, she says, which is, we should mention, this is another way of preserving, right? It's not just stuffing it in a curd jar.
Right.
And this was, Brock, you write about this. This was a very traditional method.
Well, even just the kimchi that she just mentioned, I mean, these days we might keep it in a refrigerator for our own peace of mind to know that if it's frozen, it won't kill you. But historically, kimchi is a lot like sauerkraut. It's a preservative that comes from bacteria, and it doesn't need refrigeration historically. So it's changed a lot how we think about food and the things that we need to do to make ourselves feel safe. But they didn't have any of that historically, and maybe a few died. I don't know. But I think a lot of people were nourished.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. The alcohol is just another way of preserving the crop. If you want to keep your apples, you put them in cider, and your cider keeps for the winter rather than keeping fresh apples or what have you.
Yeah,
that's an interesting point, though, because there are a lot of things that you can cold store for months that people just don't do anymore, like butternut squash and apples and pears. And if you have just a couple of simple boxes and some sawdust or newspaper and a cold spot in your house, you literally can eat fresh squash from your garden all winter long.
Mm. Last year, I harvested my onions from my garden, put them in a cardboard box on the porch. It's an enclosed porch. But they kept all through the winter. Right. We ate our own onions from our own garden all through the winter.
A good dark spot in your garage.
This is what my dad does. Yeah. My dad does this with tomatoes.
Potatoes. Yeah, tomatoes. You can keep tomatoes for a really long time.
Yeah.
I think it's a really rewarding way to preserve your food and also a lot healthier than, say, cooking and canning your food because you're not kind of cooking the nutrients out. A cool, dark place for your onions and potatoes is great. You can also dig a kind of mini root cellar, dig a trench in your yard, 18 inches deep, 18 inches wide. Put your food in those woven feed bags is what they're called, and put your carrots and your root vegetables in there. Do it for a couple weeks, and then you can go out and dig those up in the winter and have fresh, cold food ready to go and supply you for a couple weeks.
Yeah. Last summer, when we got done with the summer, we didn't even dig our carrots. Right. We just put leaves.
Keep them there.
We left them in the ground, put leaves over the top, and every time there was a slight thaw in the weather, we'd go out and dig a few, and they kept all through the winter, and they were so tasty, so much more than the grocery store.
Let's go back to the phones. Kay is joining us in Bountiful. Hi, Kay.
Hello.
Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
My friend and I, both of us are 75, decided to go into the tomato business this year and planted 300 heirlooms.
Wow.
And it's kept us young. Your program has reminded me of what we're doing right now. We're both busy dehydrating the heirlooms, our peaches, our apples, and just now I was thinking on your program, I wished I had been able to get hold of some corn at a good price because I would have dried it in the evaporated canned milk and put it on a sheet and turned it for a few days until it was dry enough not to mold and then let it dry right through and tie it up in the attic with a rope, and it's dried corn for the winter.
Wow.
And when you reconstitute it, it's the most delicious corn you've ever tasted. Just add water and boil on the stove.
Wow.
My daughters both can. No, just one cans. The other...
The good one.
The other one buys fresh produce from the stands in Salt Spring Island. So she knows how to eat. But she likes to garden.
That's great. Kay, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, and I was just thinking 2 days ago, what did the pioneers eat going across the plains and when they first got there, besides the sago lilies? What were their greens? What were, the dandelion, the different things? How did they make them palatable? And I'm hoping to read this book and find out.
You will.
Thank you.
Brock, you want to give her a clue?
Well, The trail experience, coming across the trail, was a different sort of eating than once they were here in the valley. And so coming across the trail, I read about Lorenzo Young recorded his breakfast on the trail, and it was just opulent. He went out berry picking, and when he came back, somebody else also had berries, and they had berries and cream, and they had beefsteak and bacon, biscuits, and all sorts of goodness for his breakfast on the trail. So the trail didn't have to be this miserable experience that we oftentimes think of. But once they were here in the valley, I think they all pretty much starved for the first couple of years until they were able to get reliable crops going. Mm. So those were hard times here in the valley. But while they had provisions on the trail, life was good.
Allison, you want to try that corn thing, don't you?
Well, that's actually a Southern thing. I mean, I've heard about that in the South. I'd never heard of anyone doing it up here. And actually, I just picked up a bunch of okra, and I pickled a bunch of okra, and everyone wants to know why, but it's because I'm married to a Southerner, so
okay. He'll
enjoy it.
Right.
Isn't that curious why we eat the things that we eat?
Yeah.
And why do we eschew other things that we say, oh, that's not good to eat?
My mom grew okra. I wonder why. I'll ask her. From Ted Scheffler, another food writer and good friend of the program, I sure do wish I had some of the sauerkraut my mom used to put up along with my grandma's huckleberry jelly. We heard from Ed, who said, my wife and I started a canning tradition a few years ago when she was doing her master's thesis on fruit growing in Utah. Ed writes that every August now we spend a day or two with the two youngest kids picking fruit in the orchards at the Capitol Reef National Park. Then we go for a swim at a little waterfall nearby the Fremont River. As we pick the fruit, swim in the river, we talk about the people who lived in Fruita and the people like us who follow them. Stories, he writes, about fruit and people and land become part of our kids' lives and will be a way for them to connect to us when we are gone. Let's go back to the phones. Judy's been waiting in Salt Lake. Judy, hi.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
This program has triggered some really lovely memories for me. I'm in my mid-60s and grew up in Provo, Utah. And I remember my grandmother's canning kitchen in the basement. And it had a stove and great kettles, and all of the children were expected, all the grandchildren were expected to participate in the canning in the fall. And when I grew up and married, and my husband and I moved to Washington, D.C., he was working for a congressman, and I was in graduate school, and I brought with me my mason jars. And every fall, we would go up to West Virginia and buy peaches and pears, and my neighbors, you know, Washington, D.C. isn't exactly the hotbed of canning. And they thought that I was really strange until Christmas time came around, and I would give them canned peaches and canned pears, and then I became sort of famous in the neighborhood, and they would ask if I was going to can. I don't can anymore. That's a tradition that I ought to pick up, but yeah. It was just a wonderful thing to kind of bring part of my culture and heritage back to Washington, D.C. for a decade or so.
Judy, I'm glad you called. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brock Cheney is with us. He's the author of the book Plain But Wholesome, Foodways of the Mormon Pioneers. Allison Enerson is a certified food preserver. She teaches classes on food preservation for a group of local nonprofits. And Carly Gillespie, an urban farmer and co-owner of Bug Farms in Salt Lake City. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation about preserving the food of the season, which, as you know, is just coming into its fullest bounty. Back to the phones. Lester's with us in Salt Lake. Lester, hi.
Hello. We are listening, we're preparing to juice some grapes that we picked Saturday.
Good.
So, and bottle them.
Are you steaming them or crushing them?
We're steaming. We have a steamer.
Yeah.
Very popular way to put up grapes in the state.
And it's so good. So yeah. The juice, yeah.
Very yummy.
Of course, it keeps the yeast out of the juice when you do it that way.
It's lovely grapes.
Yeah. The Concords, right? This is what we're talking about, right?
What we ended up picking was some green grapes. Oh, that's delicious. We had some for dinner last night, and I had a little bit for this morning.
Nice.
Great. Lester, cheers. Thanks very much.
Well, that's not all. So we can everything, anything, but as we're in our 70s now, we've slowed down.
Yeah.
However, when our daughter went to USU, we bought her a dryer, and she dried everything.
Yeah. Are you worried when you hear that, Allison, that, you know, you hear some of these people saying they're slowing? We've already heard a couple of people say they can't do it anymore. They don't do it anymore. They're slowing down.
We have a phrase in the canning classes, and that is canning's not for sissies. I mean, it's hard work.
And it's hot.
It's hot, and it's hard work, and it's time intensive, and it can be labor intensive, and that's one of the things I love the most about it. It helps you understand the difficulty. I mean, how much work actually goes into making food?
Yeah.
And when people forget that, that's when we really lose our way. So getting a group of people together and 50 pounds of tomatoes or 50 pounds of apples for applesauce or whatever it is, it gives you a real appreciation for how much work goes into food when you do it the right way. So it's always better to be in a kitchen with three or four good friends or your grandmother and, you know, two
exactly.
kids or whatever. It's got to be a community effort because, it may, you know, many hands make light work.
I found a story in the book here. A woman down south was telling about when she was young, they would get the young folks together for a cutting bee. And they would bring in a wagon load of peaches or apples or what have you. And then all the young people would go to work just paring it down, getting it ready to go onto the drying racks. And then, of course, afterwards, a dance and some canoodling and so on.
Can you preserve pretty much anything?
Pretty much. I mean, there's a way to preserve everything from vegetables to meats to juices. The difficult things are really like dairy and eggs and, you know.
Meat.
Meat is not as easy. I mean, you can dry it. You can can it. We're actually teaching canning chicken on Tuesday. We're going to pressure can chicken, which makes some people kind of nervous. But, you know, you'll buy it in a can at Costco, but, you know, it's
but
weird
when
it's in a jar.
We have defaulted to the jar again, the Kerr jar, the ball jar. Why not stuff it in sausage and culture it with bacteria to make a cured, dried, preserved sausage? Or, you know, why
well,
not?
Well, that depends on the size of your meat grinder.
Turn it to right? jerky.
There are people doing that here in town.
Layer it in salt and pack it in barrels.
Right.
Or,
well, yes. Let me ask you, though. This does raise a pretty serious question. That is, how dangerous can this be if you don't know what you're doing?
It's very dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah. I put the fear of botulism in everyone that comes through the door at the canning classes. And it's very rare. You get a handful or less deaths from botulism in the country every year. But it's out there. And the last thing you want to do is kill someone by giving them a jar of Graham's chili sauce, right?
Right.
So you have to know, again, you just have to know the processes. And it's science. It's pH levels and it's acidities of foods and all those things, you know, you need to know what you're doing. And yeah. Someone will teach you, and it's not that hard. And once you know, you're good to go.
Yeah.
Though, I imagine if you put enough salt on anything,
Or sugar.
Yeah, you could. If you lay on the salt, just like our Great Salt Lake, nothing grows in that lake because nothing can live in that saline environment. So if you take a piece of beef, salt it well, it'll be safe. It might not taste too good for a while. You'd have to soak the salt out of it, but.
Well, and that's the difference. I mean, we're talking now about food preservation in a lot of ways, not out of necessity, but out of joy, right? So do you want to buy – I want to go get my fresh local grass-fed beef from Canyon Meadows, yeah. Not necessarily pull it out of the basement.
Exactly.
We heard from Julie is called. I don't have much time for a call, but she mentioned that she hadn't heard many men calling in about canning, although we just did hear one. She says her boyfriend is the household canner, makes pears and salsa out of their garden. Heard from Ann, who writes that we live on land in Holiday, and my grandpa purchased from the original homesteaders in 1930s. Planted about a third of an acre of grapes, and we are getting ready to juice. Let me say this. As we were getting ready for the show today, we were reminded of a story by Constance Crompton. She was a reporter here at KUER a while back. And in October of 1991, she created this piece about her mother and about the kitchen ritual of saving the fruits of summer.
I started when a tomato would barely fit in my hand, and the paring knife felt awkward and dangerous. My mother and I leaned over the sink in our steamy kitchen. Boosted by a footstool so I could reach the countertop, I balanced each tomato on a spoon, lowering it carefully. My mother patiently watched me fill the huge quart jar. When we had 7 bottles ready, we added salt to each, then tightened the lids before they plopped and bubbled in a boiling bath. Jars lined the kitchen counter to cool and seal. Sometimes we'd hear that ping long after we'd gone to bed. When I'd written my initials and the date on the lids, they lined the shelves of our fruit room. We saved each season's harvest in clear glass jars, first apricots in the heat of summer, then peaches, pears, apples, and tomatoes in September, and chili sauce in October. Let the wind bear the trees and the days shorten. We were ready for the first dark morning when I reached into the cellar, brushing past a cobweb, then seizing two jars from the dark. If I got it right, I wouldn't have to reach in again. The pears were sweet, the applesauce tart, but it was the apricot nectar, radiating shades of sunset, thick and rich, that held the taste of summer each time I'd pry the lid from the jar. Years later, in a far city during frozen January, I slipped along icy streets into the neighborhood market, looking for a taste of home, and found it in small, pricey cans I carried up 6 blocks and 11 floors, where I savored each sip. When I traveled home, my mother had a cardboard box with my name on it. Inside, brilliant russet jars. That past July, she had stood at the sink alone, saving summer for me. Now the garden ripens, and I say I'm too busy, and she says she's too tired. Her seasons begin to shorten, and I know what will follow. So I keep those jars safe for the dark morning when I stand at my sink alone and break the seal on all the warmth of summer.
That's writer Constance Crompton. Today in the program, we had with us Brock Cheney. He's author of the book Plain But Wholesome, Foodways of the Mormon Pioneers. Carly Gillespie was also with us, an urban farmer with Bug Farms in Salt Lake City. And Allison Enerson, a certified food preserver who teaches classes for a group of local nonprofits. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.